It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear a new episode of the WPR podcast, Mapped Out, which looks back at how state Republicans turned their attention to new electoral maps after taking control of state government in 2011. First, a former Facebook employee criticized the company in testimony before Congress yesterday, and lawmakers on both sides of the aisle said they agreed about the need to regulate social media companies. Here's Democratic U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal talking about that bipartisanship at a press conference after the hearing yesterday.
If you closed your eyes without knowing who was talking, you wouldn't know whether it was a Republican or Democrat. You wouldn't know what part of the country they were from, because everywhere, red state, blue state, east and west, every part of the country has the harms that are inflicted by Facebook and Instagram.
It's a week in Washington. We'll talk about the possibility of regulation for social media companies and more. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more regulations for companies like Facebook and Instagram and Twitter? Do you feel like you see too much angry, hateful content? According to that whistleblower, that's the plan in the algorithms that send us content on social media. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Lauren Gambino is a political correspondent for The Guardian U.S. Lauren, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we had this former Facebook employee, Frances Haugen, the whistleblower who released a lot of information to the Wall Street Journal, testifying there. What was it about her testimony that caught the attention of Democrats and Republicans here?
I think it was a couple of things. First and foremost, she brought forward a lot of documents. She turned over troves and troves of internal Facebook documents that will be critical both to senators and the public to sort of understand what is happening inside of Facebook. That's a very, very rare look. Typically, when the heads of big tech companies, and of course, and Facebook in particular, when they come before these panels, they're very circumspect, they're very on message. They often, you know, tell senators, we'll get back to you, and that's kind of the eye-rolling response that they get. And here you have someone who came forward, sort of brought the receipts, as they say, and was very clear in what she thought needed to be done to maybe fix Facebook. She was open that she wants the company to succeed. She actually doesn't believe in breaking up Facebook, but she did have some ideas on how Congress and might regulate this tech giant, and she brought some solutions as well as evidence that the members of the panel can use to come up with maybe some legislation or regulation.
And this is different than usual. Sometimes we get Democrats unhappy about kind of a monopoly position of social media companies or about amplification of conservative groups or these troll farms from Eastern Europe that promote conservative ideas. Mm-hmm. Republicans upset sometimes about former President Trump being banned from platforms, they say, for violating terms of services. It seems like Republicans and Democrats might agree on this thing where algorithms are pushing divisive messages. They both seem to be kind of unhappy about that. Is that what you were seeing?
Absolutely. They seem to really be on the same page for a change. We exactly as you say, often these hearings are about scoring political points or making a political point. And this was very different. There was talk about what they can do with these algorithms, whether, what kind of legislation or perhaps an outside oversight body that might be able to regulate these algorithms and how they amplify. One example is these harmful messages for teenage girls. And so I think, it was much more solutions oriented, and it did seem like a very rare thing for Washington. Senators from both parties were on the same page about this, and there seemed to be a real sense of urgency that they need to act and that Congress has to do something. As a caveat, they do say this every time there's a big hearing. But this did seem different because I think now they're getting some of that information that they hadn't been able to get from the company itself. And that is going to inform, I think, how they go forward. And they've also made it clear that they want her to continue testifying before other committees. So we'll hear more from her.
Talking to Lauren Gambino from The Guardian U.S., looking at some of the top stories in national politics, including this testimony yesterday from a former Facebook employee, a whistleblower, and some bipartisan calls for more regulation by Congress of Facebook and other big social media platforms. You can join in with your thoughts on that if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Do you see what the whistleblower was talking about? A lot of divisive messages popping up in your various social media feeds. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You said more hearings scheduled, Lauren. What kind of timeline are we seeing for hearing more from this whistleblower, maybe bringing in social media companies themselves for more talks, and then maybe that leading to legislation? How long would that take?
Well, the timeline, I won't even guess at the timeline for all of this. But I don't know if there's been a hearing actually scheduled, but other committee chairs have said they'd like to hear from her. You know, interestingly, Adam Schiff, who is with the Intelligence Committee, and he is looking at the January 6th attack on the Capitol, he said that some of these documents might be able to help them with their investigation, to help further the look into the Capitol riots. So there's a lot of ramifications of this. Of her testimony and the documents that she brought forward. We're also hearing from lawmakers saying they want to hear directly from Mark Zuckerberg. Facebook has really pushed back very strongly against some of this testimony, saying that she's mischaracterizing their algorithm, that she didn't have a good view of how the algorithm worked from her position at Facebook. And so I think the lawmakers want to hear what Mark Zuckerberg has to say, and of course they really want to press him to you know, explain himself, because obviously these documents are pretty shocking. Some of the things that she alleged is pretty shocking. So you know, the lawmakers are calling this the big tobacco moment, and I guess we'll see if that's true. We'll see if this truly is a turning point, and they're able to come together and pass legislation that does regulate Facebook and other tech companies. But I think it's a very big question mark.
We're going to talk more about this on Friday, especially as it relates to the flow of misinformation in American politics. Now, Lauren, I want to move on to the debt ceiling. Once again, we are approaching this debt default if Congress doesn't raise the debt limits. Another game of chicken here. Some developments today. What is going on?
Yes, we are dangerously close to this sort of deadline of when we could default or not be able to pay to borrow and make good on our debt. But today, Mitch McConnell has put forward an offer to Democrats. So the context is Republicans have been actually blocking Democratic attempts to raise or suspend the debt limit. And that's because they think Democrats who control both chambers of Congress and the White House, they should be able to do this on their own. Now, in the Senate, you need 60 votes because of this filibuster. And so Republicans it's evenly divided, 50-50, Republicans have not been giving Democrats those 10 votes. They've been denying every effort by the Democrats to pass legislation. Their position is that Democrats should use a special budgetary process to raise the debt limit on their own. The Democrats say that takes far too long and it's a risky process. They'd rather do it with majority vote. Today, we saw Mitch McConnell offer Chuck Schumer sort of a way out, a way to raise the debt limit. And he gave him two options. One is to raise the debt limit through December. The other is to use this budgetary process known as reconciliation. And he said that Republicans wouldn't make that as long and painful of a process as they could. So it's unclear, I think, as of right now, these negotiations are truly ongoing as we're speaking. But there does seem to finally be some movement forward. And you can now start to see that there will likely be a path to avoiding a debt default.
We're talking to Lauren Gambino, political correspondent with The Guardian U.S. She's with us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, infrastructure plans. Some Democrats saying, okay, the $3.5 trillion over 10 years, maybe that needs to be smaller. Good idea? Or do you want to get rid of it completely or go big? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Also coming up, we'll look at the politics of abortion leading into the midterm elections. Is this a big voting issue for you? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our look at some of the top stories in national politics. Lauren Gambino is with us from The Guardian US. You can join in with your thoughts on the ongoing infrastructure saga. Do you want to see something passed, something big, something smaller? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Also coming up, the politics of abortion in the upcoming elections after a law in Texas, another one making its way through the courts from Mississippi. Will this be a big voting issue for you coming up next year? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Lauren, the debt ceiling we just talked about. Also, in the midst of all of this, negotiations over the two separate infrastructure bills. The big one with a lot of social safety net stuff could get smaller, it sounds like. What is the talk there?
We actually heard President Biden say yesterday that it almost certainly will get smaller. That's what he's telling members of his party. And he, you know, right now he's just trying to bring, he's trying to find a sweet spot where he can get all of these different Democrats on the same page. You know, he has said he's been pretty upfront about the numbers. He has 48 votes in the Senate right now, and he needs 50. There are two holdouts who are just not happy with the size of the package, and so a lot of the negotiations are around what these two senators, Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Senators Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. So it's what they want. They're also having to deal with some dynamics in the House. There's a group of moderates that were pretty upset that the House didn't end up having this vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill. They were hoping to have that done and sent to the president's desk for a vote before the end of the month. And here we are still negotiating. So, you know, Biden took the show on the road yesterday. He went to Michigan, and he's really trying to sell this agenda. He's trying to tell the public, you know, what's actually in the bill. We've come to call the bill the $3.5 trillion. Clearly, it's not going to be $3.5 trillion. They're going to negotiate it down. And so he's trying to remind voters, this is actually what's in it. This is what, you know, what the trillions and trillions of dollars are actually going to be spent on, and really build support from the public and from the outside.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Monticello. John, hi.
I'm from Montello.
Oh, Montello. I'm sorry. A little typo here.
Yeah, that's fine. I believe that they should get rid of the $3.5 trillion and not even the $1.2 or whatever they want to do, completely throw it out because there's too many social programs in it. There's only 6% that is truly for infrastructure. And as far as the debt ceiling, let the Democrats vote on it themselves. They don't need the Republicans. Let them be the ones that change the debt ceiling and turn this country into a disaster.
John, thanks for the call. John, saying what a lot of Republicans in the Senate are saying, let the Democrats do that debt ceiling vote on their own, and probably it'll come up around election time, as it sometimes does.
Absolutely. That's what has been at the heart of this. Democrats, you know, say this should be a bipartisan vote because they don't want Democrats, or they don't want Republicans running attack ads saying, look, Democrats raised the debt limit. In recent days, we've seen some pushback, though, from Democrats pointing out that actually to raise the debt limit, it's doing so to cover costs incurred under, you know, under the previous administration. Only a small fraction of that would be the spending that has happened so far since Biden took over. So their argument is, you know, this is a bipartisan, the debt was incurred in a bipartisan manner, so we should raise the debt limit in a bipartisan manner.
And then that 6% number, that's something that's bounced around for a while. Fact checks point out that's specifically the roads and bridges part of it, but there's lots of other infrastructure elements in it. internet, for example, rail and things like that. And then there's the debate over some of the social things, so-called human infrastructure. What do you see over that argument over how much of the infrastructure bill actually is infrastructure?
And we've seen a lot of pushback on the numbers for that. And that's because, Democrats have tried to take a very loose and broad use of the word infrastructure. But they believe that you need the sort of human element to make everything work. We're, increasingly a service-based economy, and therefore we need to invest in the people as well. Republicans supported the infrastructure bill, the $1.2 trillion bill that did pass the Senate with 19 Republican votes. So there's a lot more bipartisan support for that. And that is much more the traditional roads, bridges, internet, broadband. And so I think, we're seeing a divide in support. There's that one clearly garners some bipartisan support because, everyone's got roads and bridges at home in their district or in their state that they want repaired and upgraded. Human infrastructure, this is clearly a Democratic priority and filled with Democratic priorities, and it is likely not going to get any Republican support.
Thanks a lot for that call from Montello. We'll go now to Ivy in Evansville. Ivy, hello.
Hi, yes, I am all for the $3.5 trillion, and I think we need to invest in our future, and I see that the things that are listed in that bill as investing in our future and caring for people. I mean, there are so many unforeseen costs, like to burning coal, like asthma and health, and to the economy, like, and fisheries. Look at what's happened in California. Who bears the cost of that? And when you see companies like Exxon not paying any taxes whatsoever, that's what's going to pay for this. And people like Jeff Bezos, who take tax deductions for their kids, they don't pay hardly anything. And we need to invest now in our elderly and our young people. How can, Medicare does not pay for dental care. How does an elderly person eat without teeth? What about hearing? And, it's just, why is it called welfare when it helps people who don't make a lot of money but contribute all the time to society? And it's not welfare when corporations benefit from roads and bridges so they can ship their materials and don't pay any taxes.
Ivy, thanks for the call. A lot of what Ivy said here echoes what we're hearing from the Biden administration, saying think of this as not spending but investment. Lauren, is that what we're hearing?
And that is exactly what we're hearing. Yeah, I think she did a really nice job of summing up the administration's talking points, actually, because they are getting out there and they're saying that, this is about our future. Biden made a really interesting case yesterday. He talked a lot about China and he said, look, China's really investing in their infrastructure, both, their hard roads, bridges, hard infrastructure, and their human infrastructure. And we, we want to keep pace. We want to keep our edge is the word he used. So he made a really sort of a big picture appeal. Like we want to compete with China, and this is what we need to do to stay in that race. And so I think we're going to hear a lot more about that in the coming days, especially as the president travels around the country to make the case for his agenda. And that's exactly what they're saying. And they're all obviously saying that we need to tax the wealthy, tax big corporations and the wealthiest Americans in order to pay for this type of investment.
Thanks a lot for that call. Time for one more caller before we move on. Leo is with us in Milton. Leo, hi.
Hi. So I'm just calling about to talk about the infrastructure bill. I'm still in high school. I'm a young person. And seeing this bill and just seeing some of the, comments or opinions, I think this idea of infrastructure has changed and evolved a lot. I think it does encompass more of the Wi-Fi and social services than just roads and bridges, what's being said. So I think it's not fair to just say things like this that aren't infrastructure when everyone needs them.
Gotcha. Leo, thanks for the call. Wrapping up this topic before moving on to something else, Lauren, a timeline on the kind of investments in these projects that Leo's talking about.
Well, we've got to have the vote first. So I think the Democrats are hoping to get to wrap this up and pass an agenda. Not sure how big it will be, but by the end of the month, that's sort of their new deadline. So we'll see if that happens. And then obviously actually, you know, getting to work and starting some of these projects will be the next big phase. And that, you know, could possibly take years to really start getting, you know, the shovels in the ground, as they say. But, you know, it's got to start with the vote. So we have to see if they actually are able to pass this and find all the support from the Democrats that they need.
Leo, thanks for that call. Lauren, in our last couple of minutes, you reported on the group Emily's List, supporting generally Democrats. They have a big focus on abortion politics for the next couple of years. What kind of things did you hear?
Yeah, so I spoke to their new president, and, you know, they only back pro-choice candidates, so candidates who support abortion rights. And they think that it's going to be a major issue, not just for Democrats, but also but broadly for women across the country. They are betting that women are going to be very upset with these efforts in Republican legislatures and possibly at the Supreme Court level to roll back abortion rights, to make it harder to get an abortion. We saw in Texas, there was, you know, the most strict abortion law in the country, has almost entirely eliminated abortions in the state. So Democrats and Democratic candidates are betting that this will be a political winner for them, that women, even if they're independent or maybe Republican leaning, will think, you know what, this has gone too far. In the past, though, we have seen abortion be actually more of an energizing issue for the right. Typically, you know, the anti-abortion movement gets really excited about the opportunity to elect anti-abortion, pro-life candidates. So I think there is going to be a big question about which side excites more. And, you know, I think we'll learn a lot about, there's been a lot of polling on where the country is on abortion. And I think now this election might actually test that. You know, is this really a pro-choice country? You know, do majorities really support Roe? We might have a better sense of that as the election, 2022 elections approach.
Lauren, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Lauren Gambino, political correspondent for The Guardian U.S., with us for our weekly look at the top stories in the nation's capital. Coming up after the news, we'll hear a new episode of the WPR podcast, Mapped Out. We'll head back 10 years and hear how the election that brought former Governor Scott Walker into office led to our current electoral maps. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, there's been a rise in plastic surgery procedures in recent months, according to some research. Find out why tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, each week at this time, we're hearing new episodes of the podcast Mapped Out from WPR Reports, exploring the origins of our state's current electoral districts and what that's meant for our politics. Last week, we learned how the process of redistricting works after the U.S. Census every 10 years and what happens when a political party gerrymanders district lines for partisan advantage. In this episode, Bridget Bowden and Sean Johnson look back at the statewide elections 10 years ago and how they decided who got to draw Wisconsin's electoral maps and how.
It can be dangerous to predict how future historians might write the political history of Wisconsin, but it seems like they might have a lot to say about the year 2011.
Because in terms of state politics, 2011 was the year that changed everything.
Wisconsin had this reputation as a progressive beacon that went way back, more than a century. From labor protections, to breaking up monopolies, to the nation's first state income tax, this was part of our legacy.
And then 2011 happened.
If you lived in Wisconsin in 2011, and even if you didn't, you might remember it was kind of chaotic.
Scott Walker, a conservative Republican from Milwaukee County, has just been elected governor. And about a month after he takes office, he introduces a plan that would decimate the state's public employee unions.
Suddenly, people who normally don't care much about state government do. Tens of thousands of people show up in downtown Madison for weeks. Every day you hear crowds chanting.
People literally take over the Capitol. Some of them actually live there for a while. They're shouting and drumming off and on all day, and then at night, they line the building's marble floors with their sleeping bags. Then they start all over again in the morning.
One day in March, 100,000 people show up at the Capitol for a rally. They spill out onto the sidewalk and the street and into downtown. It's so crowded that it's hard to move.
The same week as that giant historic rally, the same week Walker signs the law that changes unions forever, another event goes largely unnoticed. The U.S. Census Bureau releases its redistricting data.
Republican staffers and consultants begin work at a private law firm right across the street from the Capitol. They call their office the Map Room. And at this moment in history, during this chaos, work on redistricting, one of the most consequential bills of the decade, quietly begins.
From WPR Reports, I'm Bridget Bowden.
And I'm Sean Johnson. This is Mapped Out. Now, we just said redistricting began quietly, but it's not like it snuck up on people. It happens every 10 years on a schedule. Remember episode one? The census happens every decade and then redistricting. This was not a surprise.
In fact, just a year before, in the 2010 campaign for governor, one of the candidates actually made it part of his platform.
Well, good morning. I'm very, very pleased this morning to have just submitted my papers to become a candidate for governor here in the state of Wisconsin.
Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett, the Democrat running that year, held a press conference outside the state's elections agency on the day he turned in his nomination papers. He was talking about redistricting. He wanted to change the way the state drew its maps.
Barrett's plan would have given the state's elections board more power over the process. He also wanted a new requirement in state law. Redistricting plans must be competitive.
That it certainly is worth exploring a very serious alternative to do this in a way that makes it less partisan, less litigation-driven, in the hopes that we can get a truly representative democracy here in the state of Wisconsin. Thank you very much. Thank you.
This might be a good time to remind you about what government looks like in 2010. It's easy to forget, but at the time, Democrats are running everything.
And we mean everything. The White House, the U.S. House and Senate, the Wisconsin Governor's Office, and the full Wisconsin Legislature. But those Democrats haven't really made redistricting a priority. Tom Barrett is one of the only people talking about this. And later, even Barrett basically abandons the issue. Because this is 2010.
This is 2 years after President Obama was elected, just a few months after he signed the Affordable Care Act. The Great Recession is still fresh on people's minds, and so is Obama's federal stimulus package.
There's a backlash against Democrats, and the Republican base is fired up. GOP strategists are looking for ways to seize power.
One of them is Republican Chris Jankowski. In 2010, he's running a national group that's focused on state races. He knows the power that state legislatures hold, and he pitches that to donors.
If they would just give me 10% of what they were spending federally, I swear I could, you know, have an impact.
Now, Jankowski's group always focuses on state races. It's kind of their niche. But he knows they matter most of all this year, a year ending in zero, because whoever wins will be in charge of redistricting.
He creates a program called REDMAP, the Redistricting Majority Project. The goal? Flip state legislatures to give Republicans the power to draw maps.
Jankowski's group funnels this national money to local districts where the numbers suggest Republicans could win.
We used data and objective research. We didn't have to actually meet the candidates to know what we could do.
Now, his group is hardly the only one spending money in 2010. Republicans and Democrats and their political allies around the nation throw billions of dollars around.
But Jankowski's group is methodical, targeted.
They get involved in races where people don't necessarily expect it. And they do this in districts all over the country, including districts in Wisconsin.
Leading up to Election Day, pretty much everyone expects Republicans to do well. This is historically how it goes in midterms. When one party controls everything, the pendulum tends to swing back the other way.
But on election night, when results start rolling in, they're dramatic.
The Republicans ride a wave of voter anger to take back control of the House. What's flashing red are the seats that used to belong to the Democrats.
Look at the swath of red, a sweep, just a bloodbath for the Democrats in Pennsylvania. You cannot underestimate how much change in America is now colored red. It was blue in 2006. It was blue in 2008. It is red now. It is Republican. And Democrats looking ahead to 2012, beginning with the president. We're going to hear from him.
Plenty of states get swept up in this wave. But nowhere does it hit harder than in Wisconsin. In the governor's race, Walker handily beats Barrett.
In the race for U.S. Senate, Republican Ron Johnson beats progressive icon Russ Feingold. Republicans flip Wisconsin's congressional delegation. And in the state legislature, Republicans capture majorities in the Senate and Assembly.
It's apparent almost immediately that Republicans have won more than just one election on November 2nd of 2010. They've won the biggest prize of all, the power to draw the maps that will shape elections for the next decade.
How the maps came together after the break.
We're listening to the second episode of the podcast Mapped Out from WPR Reports, looking at the impact redistricting has on our politics and who represents us at the state capitol and in Congress. We'll hear more from Sean and Bridget about the creation of the state's current maps in just a minute. That's up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now we're listening to a new episode of the WPR podcast Mapped Out. This week, Sean Johnson and Bridget Bowden are looking back at the 2011 election that brought former Governor Walker into office and a Republican majority into the state legislature. That election would have a major impact on the creation of our current political boundaries.
One of the people watching the election results come in that night in 2010 is Republican strategist Joe Handrick.
Handrick has decades of experience in politics. He ran his first campaign for the state legislature when he was still in college in the 80s. He eventually won seats in the state assembly and senate, not to mention a stint as chairman of the Northwoods town of Minocqua. And his interest in politics goes way back.
Yeah, it probably happened sophomore year in high school when I became to the realization that I was never going to be a starter on the football team, and I was never going to be a starter on the cross-country team. But boy, I was good at figuring out how to get elected to student council.
Eventually, Handrick leaves office to become a Republican political strategist. And when we say strategist, that's probably selling it short. When it comes to elections, Handrick's brain is like a computer. He sees patterns that other people might miss.
And when Republicans win, he knows it's a big deal for his party because he specializes in redistricting. He worked on maps for Republicans in the 1990s and the 2000s. He's so highly regarded by Republicans that they hire him again in 2011.
So I was basically a contract hire.
And when he says contract hire, there are a few layers to that. Handrick was hired by a law firm that was hired by another law firm that was hired by Republican legislative leaders to help with the map drawing.
Handrick and the other map drawers don't work from the state capitol. They set up shop across the street at the private law firm Michael Best and Friedrich. They call their office the map room.
Handrick isn't working alone. There are also some lawyers and legislative aides who work for the two most powerful people in the legislature, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald and Assembly Speaker Jeff Fitzgerald. And yeah, they're brothers.
They also set the agenda for everything that goes through the legislature, including redistricting.
But they use a tactic here that's not typical for most legislation. They force every rank-and-file Republican lawmaker to sign confidentiality agreements. Some people call them secrecy oaths.
One by one, every GOP senator and representative visits this law firm for their chance to see their district, and their district only. And under the terms of the confidentiality agreements, they have to keep it private. Handrick says he wouldn't have done all that, but it wasn't really his call. He says he had a specific assignment.
So my focus was on having a map created that could pass court muster.
Pass court muster. Yes, even when there's single party control, courts can still be involved in redistricting, but their role is different.
Mostly, courts are looking at whether the map meets the requirements of the Voting Rights Act. That is, a map has to make sure that the voice of minority communities gets heard, that they can vote for the candidates they want.
This is one of Hendrick's specialties, making sure a map meets this rule by drawing what are known as majority-minority districts.
My source of selfish pride has always been that this kid from up north has been able to have a real and tangible role in helping improve minority representation in Wisconsin.
Also, remember those traditional redistricting criteria we talked about in the last episode? Districts have to be equal in population, compact, contiguous, and respect local boundary lines. Hendrick wants a map that satisfies all those, too.
I've had a real good knack for being able to take the complex competing criteria and make them work together.
To hear Hendrick describe this, it's an art. Every mapmaker can prioritize these criteria in different ways.
Hendrick puts an emphasis on compactness. He doesn't want to see funny-shaped districts. He says those are how you know a map is gerrymandered.
But here's the thing. Other mapmakers disagree, including one who worked with Hendrick on the 2011 map.
His name is Keith Gaddy. He's a professor at the University of Oklahoma, and he's written a bunch of books about politics. He even wrote a chapter about Hendrick in one of them.
In 2011, Keith Gaddy is such an expert in redistricting that he gets hired in states all over the country to help draw maps. This is his second time working on redistricting in Wisconsin.
At a forum in 2020, Gaddy said there's nothing inherently good about prioritizing one of these criteria over another. So, for example, Hendrick doesn't like funny-shaped districts. But Gaddy said that doesn't matter.
Yeah, and optics matter, but optics can fool you, which is we could draw you a perfectly square district that was a gerrymander. I'm not sure where it would be, but we know we could do this thing. So don't let shape fool you.
And remember what Hendrick said about creating minority districts?
Gaddy said that can actually help Republicans. Think of it this way. Black voters, especially in Milwaukee, overwhelmingly vote Democrat. So when they're packed in to a small number of districts, it gives Democrats less power in the legislature.
So in crafting majority-minority districts, you're necessarily going to introduce some skew in the map that will naturally tend towards a Republican advantage.
If it seems like Gaddy has a different view of mapmaking than Hendrick, well, it's because he does. Mapmaking is super complicated. There's a lot to argue over. And even mapmakers who worked on the same project together can have different priorities.
So, with something so complex, how does a mapmaker explain this stuff? Not only to the general public, but to legislators.
Because remember what we learned last episode in Mr. Olson's government class? In Wisconsin, the state constitution says the legislature is responsible for drawing the maps. They get a chance to vote on the plan like any other bill.
On July 11th, 2011, the redistricting bill that mapmakers have been working on behind closed doors for months is introduced.
And by the way, this is the very first time that Democratic lawmakers get to look at this at all. Even though that private law firm has been working for the legislature, Democrats were not allowed to see their own districts or anyone else's.
2 days later, the redistricting bill gets its first and only public hearing.
Joe Hendrick doesn't testify at this hearing. Neither does Keith Gaddy.
And the Fitzgerald brothers, the two most powerful people in the legislature, they don't testify either.
My name is Tad Ottman.
They send Tad Ottman and Adam Foltz, their legislative aides who are working across the street in the map room.
Ottman does most of the talking, and he starts right away by saying their map meets the traditional principles of redistricting.
Equal population, sensitivity to minority concerns, and compact and contiguous districts.
When Foltz testifies, it's all about numbers. He rattles them off without stopping.
Same applies to Assembly District 29, also overpopulated by somewhere around 9,000 people. It shrunk to shed its overpopulation, and 28 was the least growing of the three, only 2,000 overpopulated.
Shrunk it's a lot of information to take in.
Some of what Ottman and Foltz say that day contradicts itself.
For example, they say they decided to put the cities of Kenosha and Racine together in one Senate district.
So it unites two urban, large urban areas that...
That decision, Ottman says, let them keep rural areas separate.
But in Sheboygan, they kind of did the opposite. They could have put the entire city in a single assembly district surrounded by a rural area. Instead, they chopped it in two.
Either choice is legally valid. It's a matter of making a choice on the map.
You get a sense at this hearing that the lawmakers listening, even the Republican chairing the committee, are a little overwhelmed.
All right, well, thank you for your thorough comments this morning. I kind of feel like I'm back in Statistics 101 here, and appreciate your work on this.
When lawmakers start to ask questions, they typically want to know about their districts. They know these places. Why did you move a line here or there? What was your reasoning?
Ottman fields most of the questions, and his answers are the same. The map meets the traditional redistricting criteria. Therefore, it's legal. He comes back to this over and over.
As I kind of started out my presentation, there's three core principles that go into any reapportionment plan, and that's equal population, compact mm-hmm. and contiguous, and sensitivity.
But as I mentioned,
there are different legal principles, and making a choice on those principles may lead you to compromise the other principle right. or to weigh the other.
I know I'm going to sound like a broken record, but it kind of comes back to the same point. It's there are reapportionment principles that are applied to any map drawing, and you have to make choices between them.
For most of the hearing, the room is quiet. And this is pretty unusual for this period in Wisconsin history. Remember, this hearing is happening in between the passage of Scott Walker's big union law and the recall elections to come. People are mad. Hearings are often interrupted by shouting.
But there is one politely confrontational moment. Senator John Erpenbach, a Democrat from Dane County, wants to know whether they looked at any other criteria when they drew this map, like whether the map is good for Republicans.
And I'm sorry, what was your first question?
First question is, did you look at the partisan makeup of the districts?
That information was made available to all four caucuses by the GOP.
But you guys had the legal representation. We didn't.
Erpenbach asks some form of this question again and again. And every time, Ottman dodges. After a long back and forth, Erpenbach gives it one more shot.
Did the partisan makeup of the districts come into play at all when drawing the maps?
And again, Ottman comes back to the traditional redistricting criteria.
The principles were the ones I enumerated. Those were the ones that drove drawing the map.
So the answer is no?
The answer is that we follow those three legal principles by which the map...
2 days later, this committee run by Republicans passes the map. It passes the state assembly and Senate just days after that.
There are 19 ayes, 14 noes. Senate Bill 148 is passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
This is not like the other big stuff happening in 2011. There's no chanting, no outrage, and in just a few weeks, Walker signs it.
But it wouldn't be until the next election, in November of 2012, that Wisconsin would see the power of this map.
That's next week on Mapped Out.
Mapped Out is reported by Bridget Bowden.
And Sean Johnson. We're produced by Brad Kohlberg, edited by Noah Ovshinsky. Music by Carl Christensen. Additional support from Adam Friedrich.
Digital editing by John K. Wilson. And digital direction by David Hyland.
Photography by Angela Major. Artwork by John Nichols. Audio of Chris Jankowski, provided by NPR's Planet Money.
You can see more at wpr.org/mappedout.
You can hear new episodes of Mapped Out each Wednesday here on Central Time and Thursdays after 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, if you have a tough time making up your mind lately, you are not alone. We'll look at the psychology behind decision fatigue and why it's gotten worse during the pandemic. And we'll find out why Biden trade policies on China haven't changed much from the Trump administration. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. The results are in, and we have a winner of the annual Fat Bear Week competition at the Katmai National Park and Preserve in Alaska. I previewed the event early last week. The public got to vote among 12 bears in a bracket-style competition to judge which brown bear did the best job putting on weight for the winter season. The winner for the fourth time since this contest began was 480 Otis. What appealed to voters about 480 Otis? Well, his before and after pictures show a big change. A skinny fella in July, a big chonk by October. He's also an older bear, estimated at 25 years. Apparently, brown bears in the wild have a lifespan of 20 to 30 years. And he was a rags-to-riches story this year. He got going late from the winter slowdown, looking skinnier than normal, had some tooth problems too, but he still came through in the end. So it was a big comeback. Cinderella story. That's going to appeal to the fans. Remember, you can watch the brown bears of Katmai National Park on the live webcams at explore.org. Look for the Brooks Falls camera. The bears like to spend time there during the day. Not that I've been watching during working hours, except for research purposes. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.